We've been fighting a long time, and we have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Ave Maristella.
Welcome, everybody. Steven Suspidello coming at you with Dr. Mary Soha of Our Lady of La Leche Mission down in San Augustine, Florida. Because you probably already know, this is going to be a part of a longer video. The history of Florida. She's the expert on this. Well, I'll let her tell you a little bit about herself. Dr. Mary, pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much.
2 years in the making. Father Romanowski told me, call me. You got to talk to this lady. Fine, I will. And thankfully we're here. So welcome. How are you?
All right. So, well, where to begin is always fun, right? Yes. Right now I currently have the title of vice postulator. I'm one of 4 vice postulators for the Martyrs of La Florida. But it's kind of an interesting journey how I ended up here. I actually started off this journey under a picnic table on my knees in a rainstorm with a Jesuit priest. I mean, it's a good way to start, but I was studying Caterita Caquita. She was blessed. She wasn't canonized yet. And I went to my first National Native American Catholic Conference up in Marquette University. And anyway, long story short, outdoor mass, started raining, everybody dove for cover. Kateri is very good at getting you on your knees. So I'm on my knees under a picnic table in a rainstorm with this little Jesuit priest, Father Perret. So I'm like, oh, Father, what do you do? And he tells me he's Kateri's vice postulator. I'm like, oh, how's that cause going? And he says, well, not so good because we can't afford a doctor to help us investigate the medical healings. And I was like, oh, I'm a doctor. I'll do it for free. And in good Catholic fashion, he said, you got the job.
So, fine here.
So, right. So that's kind of how I got a little bit started in this role, you know, this canonization process. So, you know, I helped investigate some of the major healings, a couple of major medical miracles. But if you can't get the doctors to sign off, you can't submit it to Rome. So, I mean, these things are fraught with roadblocks everywhere you turn. And long story short, Kateri, you know, in 2012 was canonized as a saint, the first Northern Native American saint. With who was our first Native American saint? Was Juan Diego. He, you know, everybody thinks he's Hispanic, but he's really a Nahuatl Indian. His Nahuatl name is Cuauhtlatzin, which means eagle who speaks. So anyways, then in 2014, a handful of homeschooling parents in Tallahassee, Florida, they were trying to find out more of the Catholic history of where they lived. And so they started doing some research and they found out about the mission chain, about this time Governor Jeb Bush and his wife Columba had rebuilt Mission San Luis and turned it into a state park, but kept all of its Catholic heritage and traditions. And this handful of lay people said, well, let's have a Catholic history conference. So they invited historians, archaeologists, yada, yada, yada from around the state. And they invited me to come and present the Native American Catholic perspective. And so I came and gave them the life of Kateri, because there were still, believe it or not, there were still a lot of folks that didn't believe that Native Americans were Catholic. Especially not in this area. I mean, that was like an eye opener to me. So I presented, and out of this Catholic history conference, this handful of lay people, these homeschooling parents, they did what a king of Spain, what Pope Clement XI, what an archbishop and a bishop couldn't do. And that was get the cause opened. And that in itself was absolutely amazing. The King of Spain in 1704 tried to open the cause. Pope Clement XI himself tried to open the cause. Archbishop Michael Gannon from the Baltimore area, who was doing all that work before World War II for the North American martyrs, he couldn't get the cause open. Bishop Placido Domingo Grisita, who was the first bishop of the newly formed Tallahassee Pensacola Diocese in 1982, tried to get the cause open. So kind of a neat thing that the Holy Spirit is working through these lay families, you know, to get this cause going. And so after the cause was formally accepted by Rome, I was asked to be one of the vice postulators. So that's kind of how that part of my life got going. Now, I grew up in Jacksonville, and I would ride my bike from Jacksonville to St. Augustine on the weekends, because back then, very little traffic. Your parents are like, yeah, come back in a couple of days. We'll see you then. And so I would ride my bike and always stop in here at the Mission, Nombre de Dios, and the Shrine of Our Lady of La Leche, and just have had a very strong prayer life with the shrine and the mission all my life. And it's two different things, which took me forever to learn. There's Mission Nombre de Dios, which is the parish church, which is now the Cathedral of St. Augustine. And then there's the Shrine of Our Lady of La Leche, the devotion to the Nursing Madonna. So there's actually two distinct religious centers, if you will. And so that, out of that love and a lot of prayer, I prayed that my husband would want to retire one day and come here to St. Augustine. And sure enough, you know, that prayer was answered. And we ended up actually buying a house right next to the cross on the shrine grounds. So like my neighbors on two sides are the Shrine of Our Lady of La Leche. So God's got me like, right where he wants me.
That works.
Oh yeah, it works. So the background that you see, the images that you see in the center of our house, we found out was probably the last wooden chapel to Our Lady of La Leche, probably built in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And so when we found that out, I mean, the house was a disaster when we bought it, but when we found that out, we kind of had to, couldn't renovate without having it back to a chapel. So here we are.
So what I'm told is 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And if you're lucky enough, you heard about some kind of mass that went down in St. Augustine, Florida. But that's it.
Is that no, honey. No. So 1492, Columbus was in San Salvador. So he didn't really make it into Florida. So Florida was Ponce de Leon, 1513. He landed here in St. Augustine on Easter Sunday, but he didn't stay long. It was just a cartography map-making expedition. But it's very interesting because that's how we got our name. He landed at Easter time and he called it, our full name is La Florida de Pascua, the flowers of Easter. So that's how Florida got its name. And then, you know, that was 1513, and it wasn't until 1565 that Menendez landed here. So there's a big gap in time. But, you know, I think that the history of Menendez and his goals, his original goals for La Florida, and then what eventually happened with his first trip here, I think that's of historical significance.
Yeah, just a little bit. I mean, it's one of those Catholic pride things. We hear about this first Thanksgiving. We don't know. We hear what the state's supposed to tell us to believe in. England writes our history.
Exactly.
More to it.
Well, and that, I think that's the beauty of the history that we're uncovering here in La Florida. Now, when we talk about La Florida, we're pretty much talking about the whole East Coast, because Spain claimed this land to be under her patronage. So we have to understand it was different. We're all led to believe that Spain claimed the land, ownership of the land. But Spain actually claimed the patronage. This was after 1543, when Spain took, the monarchs took a very hard stand against slavery. They took a very hard stand against the atrocities of the Spanish military in Central and South America. They took their command, their scriptural command, to go forth into all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit very, very seriously, because they understood that a soul that hadn't been baptized, you know, couldn't enjoy the gifts of eternal salvation. And that was their understanding. That was their catechesis. And so they felt this moral and spiritual call to go forth, to catechize, and to offer the waters of baptism. And I think that's what makes La Florida unique, is that we really, Native people here weren't forced into Catholicism. The catechesis here was so completely different than in the Caribbean and Central and South America. And it followed the what was called the New Evangelization in 1535 that was developed by Bishop Las Casas and Father Luis de Cancer, who ends up being our proto-martyr, who was one of the first Dominicans who was martyred here in 1549. But they developed a way of catechesis for indigenous people to preserve the integrity of the people that were about to be catechized. And so they said that before a priest could go into the fields of La Florida, he had to learn the language, the culture, the currency or the value system of the people they would be evangelizing to. And they had to be willing to go out one or two at a time without military presence to do that catechesis. Well, I joke with the parochials, but that kind of wiped out the parochial involvement. But we had one wave of Dominicans. Unfortunately, the four Dominicans, series of all kinds of issues. The four Dominicans that landed in the Tampa Bay area were all martyred. Then we had the Jesuits. The first North American Jesuit martyr, Father Pedro Martinez, was actually martyred outside of St. Augustine, north in Jacksonville, in September of 1566. So just 1 year after Menendez's landing, which was in 1565. So our story of catechesis in La Florida is very, very different, because Spain and Menendez especially were very devoted to getting it right, to sharing the gospel the right way, and respecting the Native Americans, respecting their cultures, respecting their lands. Now, the priests would draw, you know, the line in the sand when it came to certain issues like polygamy and certain games that were fatal for some of the players. And they would the priests would explain why culturally these probably weren't consistent with Christianity, and eventually that those conversions took place. So La Florida and Catholic Spain, this is a history that's not taught anywhere, I don't think, in the U.S., and certainly not from a perspective of what was Spain's ultimate goal here in La Florida. Well, Menendez initially, he had planned for almost 2 years before his initial landing here to make this purely a catechetical mission. He had used his own funds, had outfitted his own ships. He was very close to the Jesuit order, so he wanted to bring Jesuits in to do this early evangelization. And that was his initial goal for coming to La Florida. Also to try to find a son that he had lost, that he believed had been shipwrecked off of Los Martires, the Florida Keys. So that was his original goal. But in 1564, the French Huguenots erected a fort in Jacksonville, Fort Caroline, and the King of Spain saw that as an act of war. And so he cornered Menendez and said, I need you to go and get rid of this fort. You need to go and get rid of the French you know, colonization in this area. And so Menendez had to change his priorities a little bit. He came and landed on September 8th, 1565. And when he stepped off the boat for the formal landing, if you will, he kissed the cross. He kissed Father Lopez, his vestments, and they processed to where we now have the site of the rustic altar at the shrine grounds. And they said the first mass of thanksgiving. Now, the Tumuqua people in the city of Saloy, where he landed, were very intelligent people. They were gifted linguists. They had an import-export trade system because they knew how to dry fish and meat and fowl. I mean, it seems to me that they were just an amazing civilization. And when they saw that Menendez, and they knew that he was the head, the leader, when they saw him kneel and kiss the cross and kiss the priest's vestments, they imitated that because they felt this sense of sacred, that these men were coming here for something more. The mass was said. Menendez brought goods from the ship to have the first Thanksgiving mass. So it's kind of the opposite of Plymouth Rock, where the Indians had to bring food. You know, the Native Americans brought food for the pilgrims. Here, Menendez provided a pork stew and Madeira and bread and things like that for the Native Americans. It's during his initial speech when he landed, he claimed the land in nombre de Dios, in the name of God. And it was over 8 or 9 hours before he ever mentioned Spain and Spain's intentions in that area. So he kept true to his evangelistic, his missionary spirit, I think. And in those very early, you know, stages of the founding of St. Augustine. And for me, you know, where he landed and the first parish church, which we call Mission Nombre de Dios, the first parish church in the United States, there was something beautiful about the fact that he chose the Marian feast of the Nativity of Our Lady, because I can't help but feel that on this day, September 8th, when Menendez is claiming the land in the name of God, that God doesn't turn right around and give this land to Our Lady as a birthday present, because she's been our protectress almost from the very beginning. So that kind of gives you a little, you know, setting of how things happen when they landed, which is so different than the pilgrim story at Plymouth Rock.
And you can throw in, I remember reading about Queen Isabella, a letter she wrote basically calling the indigenous people her children, the children of Spain. And it was her duty to catechize them, protect them, feed them.
Right. And
help build them up.
Well, and to share the faith.
Yes.
But she was very clear about allowing for full acceptance of the faith, not a coercion like history books like to tell you that Spain came in and forced the native people at gunpoint. That did not happen in La Florida. Not at all. But, you know, it's really hard because most people in America have grown up in some sort of a Christian framework. They understand and they know that the belief is that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. So if they ever take the time to pray and get down on their knees, they already know how to pray to their Creator because they know Jesus Christ. And, you know, you have to stop and think, if we believe in one Creator God, which we do, and most Native American societies believed in one Creator God, does it make any sense at all that this beautiful, wonderful, loving Creator God would create all of these different nations and not find some way to communicate with them until they could be exposed to his Son, Jesus Christ, or they could fully participate in prayer as a human, through a human, through the humanity of Christ with their Creator? And I think that was the basis, the background, the impetus for the founding of the mission chain here in La Florida, the catechesis that happened. I mean, it had its bumps, but the majority of the Native people believed in one creator God. And you have this group of missionaries that comes and says, the Franciscans especially, they came after the Jesuits, and the Franciscans especially were excellent at saying, your spirituality is good, but we can bring you to the fullness of that spirituality. And I think sometimes in our catechesis today, we've lost that. You know, we come across as, okay, we're the one true church. We were founded by Jesus Christ. And, you know, as soon as you start doing that, other people shut down. They get defensive. But these Franciscans came in and said, we love that you believe in a creator God. We love that. We love your spirituality, because for Native people, they lived and walked always with Wonkantanka, the great mystery. And for them, now knowing how to pray to God through Jesus Christ was amazing. And word of this missionary activity spread through the Native American nations, and especially the Appalachian nations that were to the west of St. Augustine, going along the Florida Panhandle. And we even have some research that shows us that when villages found out that these priests were coming through the woods, they would go out and erect huge crosses to try to attract the priests to come to their village to begin the catechetical, you know, process. And the beautiful thing, there was kind of like this revolution, this evolution, whatever you want to call it. But the cacica or cacique, the chief, would sit down, would listen to the priests. They would decide, boy, you know, we want to learn more. So the village in Spanish terms became known as a doctrina, or a place of learning. And then after a period of time, and it was very different for each village, it depended on what the demands of the time was on the Native people. Did they have time to come to class? You know, what season was it? If it was harvest season, hunting season, the priest didn't have as much time for catechesis. But anyway, after a period of catechesis, then the priest and the chief would all agree that, oh, it's time for us to accept baptism. And then after the village was baptized or converted, then the Native people themselves would move the house of the chief, which usually occupied the center of the village because he was the center of their life. Mm-hmm. And they'd move the village to this out from the center. And that's where they would build their chapel, their tabernacle, because the purpose of becoming a mission wasn't to have a priest. There weren't enough priests to go around, but the purpose was to have Jesus living with you 24/7 in that tabernacle. Jesus now lived with the people, and they understood that. They lived it. They breathed it. You know, how many people today, when they're driving past a Catholic church, when they're driving past that tabernacle and they know Jesus is in there, do they even stop and say hello? Do they bless themselves when they're passing a Catholic church? Do they even have the presence of mind that Christ is there, body and soul, in that tabernacle? And these people lived and breathed it.
Yeah.
And I just, that just touches my heart.
It's one of those things where you hear about similar stories. When you hear similar stories, it can't be made up, because you Father DeSmit.
Yes.
You just said those guys did the same thing to him. The black robes all the way from you hear about the stories with them meeting him in the middle, putting them on their shoulder, smoking a pipe with them all day. It's something about these Indians. I mean, the visions of Maria Greta transporting over there.
Yes. Well, and the white buffalo woman, who we now believe was Our Lady, you know, and gave the covenant of the peace pipe until her son Jesus Christ was brought to the Lakota people. She was very clear about that. Lakota spirituality, ancient spirituality, is clear about that. So,
you brought up about the points about kind of like meeting where they are, because technically Our Lady Guadalupe, she's dressed in stuff that they would recognize to bring them in, right?
Well, that, and she speaks Nahuatl. She's not speaking Spanish. Uh-huh. And I mean, everything about Our Lady of Guadalupe is just, there's some, we could do six hours.
Not to get off topic, and, just comparison. Like,
We look at Our Lady of La Leche as, and we'll get into the image a little more, but we look at Our Lady of La Leche as kind of the fulfillment of one of the Guadalupan promises, because she told Juan Diego, ask the bishop to build me a little church, a little chapel. And in that chapel, I will present my newborn son to the new world. And, you know, everybody thinks, oh, she was talking about Mexico and the big cathedral and housing the Tilma. But in the Tilma, she's still pregnant. Where's the first shrine where she presents the infant Christ? It's here at Our Lady of La Leche.
Yeah, interesting.
I know. The continuity is unbelievable.
Just wanted to make sure that no one got upset going, oh, well, they should have gone in with hammer like this. Well, the guys, I think the Orient, the missionaries out there, they dressed like the people there, and they took away. It's a sales pitch. You don't go in and say, you suck, do what I do.
Yeah. It works. Well, that's why Las Casas's new evangelization was so successful. You know, you have to learn the language, the culture, and the value system of the people that you're going to share the gospel with. Because true missionary work, true catechesis, is about enculturation, allowing a people to take scripture and enculturate that, have it, you know, trickle down through every aspect of their civilization, not try to change the civilization to be everybody else's civilization. Yeah. God loves his diversity, and we're, you know, the devil's doing everything to knock it out. And we have to be, I think, cognizant of that.
I know a priest friend of mine will always say, because you want to see how diverse or creative our Lord is, or God is look at the insects and how many different insects there are.
Just look at a fly eye.
Where'd you come up with this?
I know. Exactly. Exactly. So there's a beautiful story of a Dominican, Father Vincent Ferrer de Andrade, who was the priest secretary to Bishop Altamirano in Santiago de Cuba. And they made the first Episcopal trip here to La Florida in 1606. And they traveled through the mission chain. It took about 4 months. And the bishop was baptizing and confirming along the way. And Father Vincent just fell in love with the Native Americans and how they lived out the gospel. Uh-huh. And he just, it was so beautiful to him that he actually asked to be dispensed of his Dominican vows and asked to be accepted into the Franciscan seminary that was here in St. Augustine and be reconsecrated as a Franciscan and spend the rest of his life here in the Florida mission chain. Huh. It was so beautiful. And the worst thing that history does is, you know, it knocks out the beauty and the gifts of people who truly lived a life of faith. You know, it focuses on the political, the power, the whatever, strong, but we don't, those things don't motivate the average person or the faith-filled person. It's being able to live their faith that motivates them and to come into a deeper relationship with their creator, with God. And I think that in all history, for us as Catholics, one of our calls to holiness right now is to go back and look at our past and see the good people that are in our past. There's a little quote that I like to share about how the devil uses history to block the knowledge of the kingdom of God, but God uses history to bring us into the communion of saints. And so for me, being part of this cause of the Martyrs of La Florida is like getting closer and closer to these people who had such a deep faith that they were willing to leave everything they knew and willing to die defending that faith. So, you know, that that to me is just amazing. There's a great book. It's called The Past as Pilgrimage. And it talks about narrative, tradition, and the renewal of the Catholic history. It's from Christendom Press. But I kind of use that as my roadmap, if you will, in sharing the story of the Catholic history here of La Florida, the history of the martyrs of La Florida, the mission chain. As we go back and we say, yeah, there were people who did it right. There were people that were so that lived and breathed every moment of their life believing in Jesus Christ, believing in the salvation story of man, that they were willing to die defending it.
And what you're bringing up, even at that time, bring back Father Schmidt again, there's a
point where even though he's a couple hundred years after.
It's just the same argument. That's why I popped in the head.
Yeah.
People would see the Indians then and go, are these supposed to be the savages? Because they're not what we're told back this way. So even the propaganda then at that current time, you look at the history, what we're supposed to be told now, they were screwing with people's minds in real time then.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you got to remember one of the reasons why the British and the French Huguenots and even the Dutch to a certain extent spent so much time creating this false image of the Native Americans, that they were savage, that they were uncivilized, that they were illiterate. I mean, part of that was to demean the human spirit so that it was morally okay to enslave them.
Yeah.
And it's never morally okay, but that was their approach. Well, these people aren't really human.
Yeah, they're not perfect.
And we see that a lot in the African slave trade. And unfortunately, so much of that sentiment carried through in the South, even through the 1960s. But, you know, the beauty of what happened in La Florida was that Catholic Spanish monarchy recognize these people as their own people. In fact, every time a new chief was elected, a cacica or a cacique, the king of Spain would send over a small scepter to recognize their political authority over their own people. So, you know, when people talk about Spain colonizing in the first Spanish period, I kind of cringe a little bit because that wasn't Spain's intention.
So how about some myths? You probably have some people that could correct for not just the normal Joe, but people that actually think, you know, I know this. There's, you know, they were called Indians because they thought they were in the Indies, things like that. Or
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's a good myth. And, you know, Father, that was a myth that really daunted Father Groeschel. So he's the one that actually broke. He was the myth buster on that one. But yeah, the British love to say that, you know, the reason the Spaniards called them Indians is because Columbus thought he had landed in India. And, you know, if you stop and think about it, Columbus was a phenomenal mathematician. If he didn't know anything else, he knew that the circumference of a circle is pi r squared. And he'd been a navigator. He'd been to India. He knew what people from India looked like. He also knew that when he landed at San Salvador, he hadn't gone through enough arcs, degrees, you know, of circumference to end up in India. But the word that he used to describe the people of San Salvador was indigeros, which is Spanish for indigenous ones.
I don't think I was told that in high school.
Yeah, no, probably not. Probably the British version. And that, you know, another one is as Catholic Florida, you know, started to grow and expand, and with the British incursions from South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, you know, there was this myth that if you went to Florida, that Spain forced you to become Catholic. And that's a myth. Spain said that Spain outlawed slavery in La Florida. So all people who escaped from the British plantation system, if they made it to Florida, they were given their freedom. But they had two requirements. The first requirement was they had to swear allegiance to the King and Queen of Spain, and they had to be willing to defend it. The second requirement was that they had to study the Catechism of the Catholic Church, because for them, Catholicism and Spain were one. There was no division of church and state for Catholic Spain. And we have been so immersed in this separation of church and state. You know, you can't live your faith, on a day-to-day basis, because, you know, then you would be pulling it over into the world of politics and social whatever. Yeah. But that wasn't true. So Spain felt like, if you're going to live under our rule, you have to understand our rule. You have to understand our culture. Now, the only reason that you had to be Catholic in La Florida was if you wanted to hold an elected office or an appointed office by the King of Spain, or if you wanted to hold rank in the military, you had to be Catholic. But to be a regular foot soldier or a regular citizen, you did not have to be Catholic.
So how was the life for the people? Was it a prosperous? Were the people, like the colonies looking down at Florida going, we're just jealous of them? And obviously,
Oh, no. I mean, La Florida, I think, was considered the poorest outpost of the Spanish Empire. You know, the Spaniards that were in St. Augustine pretty much relied on supplies coming up from Havana or coming over from Spain. The land here is hard to cultivate. The heat, there was a lot of fish and things like that, but it wasn't, I mean, there were no gold, no jewelry, no jewels, no, nothing like that was found here. So it was a very hard outpost for the Spaniards. The people who came here, though, the overriding thing was, again, catechesis. And so that was a big thing that kept so many men of the military that stayed here for 10, 20, 25 years. It's because they fell in love with the Catholic expression as lived by the Native Americans.
So how many martyrs are there? There was just a few, I guess, at first you guys thought, and then you found more?
The number, we're not going to have a number for a long time. Yeah. Long story short, at this point in time, we've divided our cause up into Group A and Group B. Group A is a group of 59 martyrs that we have independent research on, that we can reproduce, that's public, that we found the original transcripts on. But we know that there are hundreds more. We have some research on the others, but not enough to be concrete, especially not for the Vatican process of beatification and canonization. So Rome has asked us to divide our cause up and to go with the 59 that we're 100% for sure of. They died in defense of the Catholic faith, and just get the cause going and help the world with the awareness of, here's yet again another point in history where Catholics lived out their faith to the fullest, giving their last full measure. And I think the fact that these men, women, children, soldiers, priests, caciques, I think the fact that their life stories are starting to come to light now is amazing in this era where we're focused on trying to reinvigorate the belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. These Native American people, they believed it. They lived it with every breath. They understood it. You know, sometimes the priest would offer mass and everybody would only be able to have a little tiny piece of the host for the Eucharist, because there just weren't enough hosts to go around. But yet every Native American understood that Christ was present, physically, spiritually present in that small piece. And just to see that, and to see that these people, when the mission chain was being destroyed by the British, one, because of their anti-Catholic hatred, but two, because this belief that I have an infinite value in the eyes of God and you can't enslave me because that goes contrary to the laws of God. You know, the Native people in La Florida, they stood their ground, and the British found this, they didn't want to deal with it because they wanted to be able to subdue these native people to take them off to the slave trade for their holdings in the Caribbean and elsewhere. And man, the Florida Mission Chain, these Catholic Indians stood up to the British. And the other thing was, in that period of time, Britain was very anti-Catholic. So there was a double reason for the British to come after all these beautiful Catholic Native Americans.
So let's talk about some of those guys. There's one right behind you. Another is a priest with his altar boys. Yeah. I think he even have a baby that was.
Oh yeah, that's a separate story from the priest. Right. We can cover the priest first. The priest behind me is Father Augustine de Ponce de Leon, and he was born here in St. Augustine. He went to the Franciscan Seminary here. I'll just do a little quick commercial. The first ordination class from our seminary here in St. Augustine, you're not going to believe this, the year was 1606, and Bishop Altamirano ordained 10 men from the city of St. Augustine.
Really?
Can you believe that?
No.
I know. So it's just amazing to me that, you know, Plymouth Rock isn't even founded yet. There's no Jamestown, Yorktown. We have a seminary with a library with probably 10,000 manuscripts. And we have men that are being ordained to their Catholic priesthood. It's just beautiful. So Father Augustine is one of those men who grew up here, was ordained here. He was stationed in different places in the Florida Mission Chain. Now, he's kind of an enigma. The Timucuans write a lot about him. Because, you know, most Spaniards were about 5'4", 5'6". The Timucua people here were much taller than that. But there's one writing where a Timucua Indian says that for every 8 leaps of a Timucua warrior, Father Augustine could cover it in 6. So that's how tall he was. And he's kind of described as this, like, gregarious, loving, just wonderful parish priest, mission priest. And he was actually the mission here at Nombre de Dios and the shrine had been attacked by the British. He was at a mission across the water from the shrine. He heard about it. He came over to offer his services to see if he could help if there were any injured, or, you know, if anybody needed last rites, or could he help rescue any of the sacramentary from the shrine church, whatever, whatever. And in that process, long story short, the British were coming back through the western side of St. Augustine. The Spanish military from the fort had met them in the area approximately where the current mission and shrine are. There was this battle that ensued, and Father ran out, was in the middle of the battlefield, giving last rites, hearing confession, trying to help the injured, and he was killed in the course of the battle. So he was our first priest to be born in the U.S. to be martyred for the faith here in the U.S. So he gets a little special, you know, a little special significance.
It's his name and companions now?
And companions, yeah. Well, the martyrdom... the Group A, the martyrdom process, the beatification, it's actually Antonio Cuipa and companions. And to be historically correct, and the prayer cards are going to change, it's Antonio Inesia and companions. And Antonio is an Appalachian chief. He was the chief of Mission San Luis, which is the only mission in the Florida Mission Chain really that didn't fall to the British. The Appalachian burned it down themselves to protect to keep the British from getting their hands on it, basically. But Antonio is our prototype martyr. And he's absolutely fascinating. He was the chief of Mission San Luis, which is the mission outside of Tallahassee that's been rebuilt based on the archaeological evidence that was found. And when his parents were converts to Catholicism, and he wrote a last will and testament. And one of the things in his last will and testament, he writes how thankful he is to his parents for raising him up in this beautiful Catholic faith. And he leaves money for his wife and children. He leaves money for the mission. He has to be buried in a Franciscan habit because he was a third order Franciscan. I mean, you just see this depth of faith and formation. And you're like thinking, this is 1703. Yeah. And here's an Appalachian chief that is as well-formed in his Catholic faith as anybody today. He used to make flutes and he would play the Catholic hymns, especially the Marian hymns. And he would go out and catechize other villages that may not have accepted Catholicism yet. He was a great agriculture. He had a great mind for agriculture and husbandry. He was a great carpenter. His own villagers called him their Saint Joseph because he treated all of the people like his children, like his foster children. And he was a carpenter. So he was just an amazing person. He did something in the last paragraph or two of his last will and testament that made me have to go change my will. He left enough money so that 50 masses would be said for his soul when he died.
Eh.
Talk about an insurance plan, you know?
He knew the deal.
Yep. So we just felt the canonization committee, when we were trying to, you know, pray for discernment on who our prototype martyr should be, Antonio just, he just fulfilled everything.
Leader of the pack.
Yeah, definitely. We can talk about his martyrdom little bit, but it's a little, you know, gruesome. The British
have gruesome on here. So.
Okay. Well, the British,
it's more beautiful gruesome in a sense.
Okay. Well, you know what I mean? It shows what they went through. I mean,
right behind me is the altarpiece from the Carthusians in England.
Yep, there you go. It's like, yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, no watered down stuff here. So Antonio had heard that a nearby Mission Ayubale, had been attacked by the British and the Creeks. Now, the British, when they landed and they realized there was no gold, no silver, no emeralds like the Spanish had found in Central and South America, they had to find a way to turn their trips, if you will, into something economically feasible. So they turned to agriculture. Well, the only way to make agriculture economic is slave labor or very inexpensive labor. And so what they did was they befriended the Creek Indians and the Yamasee Indians. They gave them alcohol and guns. Well, the guns make them more powerful than any other nation. None of the other Indian nations had it. The Spanish government was very careful not to give guns to the native people. It was not part of their culture. There was no need. You know, they had very good hunting and fishing skills. They didn't need them at the time. And then the alcohol, of course, made the Indians very dependent on the British. So the Creeks and the Yamasee with the British, they wiped out like the Cherokees and maybe up around the Potomac area. But every time they made their incursions into Florida, they met with this horrible resistance. So the British taught the Creek and the Yamasee to be very anti-Catholic. And what they would do is they would attack these missions under British leadership, but then the British would stand back and allow the Creeks to inflict all kinds of torture on the native people. Their first goal was to capture the priest if they could, and to make an example out of him by a horrible torture and martyrdom. Or they would capture the cacica or the Anisha, the second in command, or their family. And the Indians that they did manage to capture for the slave trade would be forced to watch these horrible tortures, thinking that these tortures would instill fear into the Indians they had captured, and they would go along more docilely for the slave trade. Well, that kept backfiring in Catholic Florida because these people knew, having been baptized, that they were loved with an infinite love by the Creator, that they were equal to everyone else in the eyes of God, and they couldn't be enslaved. That was one part of it. The second part of it was They knew that the British did not have the sacraments, especially the Eucharist, and they were not going to leave Jesus Christ and, you know, leave their homeland because of Jesus Christ. So that was kind of the background for the mission, the military attacks of the British on the Florida mission chain. Ayubali, in 1703-04, Britain took this military action to just wipe out the mission chain, just completely destroy it. And so they were attacking systematically the missions. Ayubali, which is outside of Tallahassee, was attacked on January 24th, 1704. It was an ambush. The priest was captured. He was beheaded. His head was put on a pike. His body was burned so badly that not even his bones were left. They were all crumbled and in sand. But Antonio heard about it, and he managed to organize about 57 warriors to go with him to try to help defend Ayubali, to try to help rescue any prisoners or any injured people. So they stopped at San Pedro and Patali in the evening, another mission, and the priest there spent all night just in prayer with them, mass, confession. And in the morning, they were setting out to go to Ayubali, and the priest went with them. And all of the chiefs kept telling him, "No, Father, you can't go with us. You need to stay here. You need to stay in the safety." And he said, "Why would I send my children out to do what I'm not willing to do?" So he went with them. They were ambushed, the same as the mission the day before. 54, I think, of the Braves were captured, including Antonio and two other sub-chiefs. Antonio was put on a cross, you know, hung crucifixion style, because the Creeks like to make fun of the Catholics. A fire was lit under his feet. And all of the other Braves that were captured were forced to watch this very long, arduous torture while he was on the cross. Now, the whole time he's on the cross, eyewitness accounts say that he was preaching to his fellow Apalache brothers to be strong, you know, that this is just this pain, this suffering is just a moment in time for an eternity of glory, being in the presence of God. He was preaching forgiveness for the captors and the people that were doing this to him and to his fellow Native Americans. He was asking them to repent and recant because they were endangering their immortal souls. He was concerned about their immortal souls. So he's going on and on like this for almost 7 hours. Now the fire is under his feet. The Creek Indians are taking their knives and they're putting huge gashes in the bellies of his muscles as he's hanging on the cross. And then they would immediately put some of the hot embers, the hot cinders, into the gashes to cauterize them off so that he died this very slow and painful death from the cross. And about just before he's about to give up his life, he can't preach anymore from the cross. He's losing his breath. You know, his end is near. He gets this tremendous rush of energy and he just screams from the cross, "Be strong, my brothers, be strong. Our Lady is here with us. I am looking into her eyes, and in her eyes, I am gaining the strength and courage I need to endure this martyrdom. She is here with us, and she will take all of us to heaven." And then he dies. And it's just like, it's just such a beautiful summary of each and every one of these martyrs that we have, who is preaching forgiveness, who's defending the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, who will use every breath that they have to say, "You cannot turn me away from Christ."
Yeah. Isn't that one of the priests with the altar boys? They ended up killing the altar boys to try to get the priest to...
Well, right. And that history, we're kind of a little... We have to do some more documentation on that part of the story. But we do have like Father Sanchez and his altar boy and his sacristan, Father Sanchez, and his altar boy and sacristan were captured trying to bring sacramentary from St. Augustine back to the mission church. And the first sacristan, who was a chief, but he was young, he was around 11 years old, was told that if he ripped the Franciscan habit off Father Sanchez and he killed him, that his life would be spared. And the young sacristan said, no, I can't kill my father. And so they martyred the 11, 12-year-old sacristan. Then they went to the altar boy, who was the son of a chief, and they gave him the same offer, said, if you'll tear the habit off of this priest and you'll spit on the cross and you'll denounce this Catholic faith, we will let you live. And the young boy, I mean, he's no more than 10 or 11. And he says, no, I can't do that. This is a holy priest. He brings us the Lamb of God. I can't do this. And they martyr him. And the whole time Father Sanchez is watching all this, some of the other braves that were with Father Sanchez had escaped and they were watching from the woods. So that's how we have these accounts. And then they turn to Father Sanchez and they beat him up and they maim him and they're clubbing him. And just before they die, they kill him in a different fashion. They burn his body. We think all that was found is his bloody habit. But, you know, these men and these altar boys and their sacristans, they died defending the Eucharist, their faith and each other.
Which is the one that had the cross on it? Do you guys still have that? I guess the...
That's Ayubale. That was the first priest that was martyred during Ayubale. Mm-hmm.
In case people aren't wondering, was a part of it melted? Is that what happened?
Yes. Yeah, because they burned his body, remember, and the cross, the bottom half, the bottom third of the cross, Christ's feet, that portion of the cross below his feet melted, but then cooled quickly. So you see these little drops that look like drops of blood, but are really the metal from the cross that cooled quickly.
I'll bring up the infant. There's an infant story.
The unborn infant.
Unborn.
Yes. Okay. So this is a martyrdom that happened. This is early on. This is in the mid 1600s. And the Di Florencia family, Claudio Di Florencia was the lieutenant governor of Florida. And he and his wife, one daughter who was 13, Antonia, his married daughter, Maria, 19, who was, you know, she was pregnant and it was very obvious. So she must've been at the end of her pregnancy. Maria's husband and their roughly five-year-old child, I think about 8 Franciscans and 9 Catholic native chiefs were all together for a celebration on the Feast of St. Anthony. And they were ambushed. And so the lieutenant governor, his wife and family, 3 of the 8 Franciscans were martyred. All 9 of the Catholic chiefs were martyred. And then what they did was they tied the Di Florencia family to stakes, to like crosses, you know, stakes in the ground. And they one by one martyred the father, the mother. And the whole time, this little 13-year-old girl, Antonia, she's screaming at them, you know, you guys are endangering your immortal souls. What's wrong with you? You're going to go to hell. I mean, here she is watching her family and friends being martyred, and she's more worried about their eternal souls. I mean, that takes a lot of priority in your life to get that right. Yeah. One of the Franciscans is holding the little 5-year-old in his arms and they martyr the priest and the little 5-year-old and then his father. But when they get to his mother, Maria, Antonia is still alive and she's still screaming her lungs out that what they're doing is wrong. When they get to Maria, they see how pregnant she is and they cut the baby out and they hold the baby up. And then they kill the baby. Then they turn around and kill the mom. And this is kind of big in our martyrdom event because it's the first time where we can show that an unborn child was killed independent of the mother. So as part of this martyrdom and this cause for canonization, we can present this unborn child for martyrdom because this child was killed independent of the mother's death.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's our Catholic belief. From the moment of conception, you have a soul and you have an infinite value in the eyes of God.
Yeah, and again, also you throw in Odia Fide and then the baptism of blood, San Amoranciana. It's all right there for that. So it's I don't want to say it's easy, but that's, yeah, you see how that works.
It's just so beautiful that the Holy Spirit has arranged that we can present this.
Yeah, no, yeah. I know it could go for hours on the martyrs. I'm fine with more stories. Oh,
yeah, the martyrs are amazing. But you have to stop and think, you know, the most important thing of martyrs' stories is not how they died. It's how they lived. It's how they lived is what gave them the courage and the fortitude and the humility and the piety that's needed to, with all your consciousness, say, I will die defending you. I will give my life defending you. And, for me, one of the things is in the creed, there's two humans in our creed, right? Mary and Pontius Pilate. And so, you know, while studying the lives and the catechesis of these native people here in La Florida, I was trying to think, okay, why is Pontius Pilate in the creed? There's something positive, not something negative, because we're a people of light. We're a positive people. And so it finally dawned on me that Pontius Pilate asked Christ the right question. He didn't say, do you have a kingdom? He said, where is your kingdom? He automatically recognized Christ as king. He said, where is your kingdom? And Christ answers, my kingdom is not of this world, but there's a pause. In Hebrew, that means yet, something is coming. He said, my kingdom is not of this world yet. If my kingdom were of this world, my followers would be fighting to save me. And then what's the prayer that he taught us? The Our Father, where we say, thy kingdom come. Do we really realize that when we say that, thy kingdom come, we are saying, I will die defending you. I will defend you at all costs. And so for me, these native people, they made that connection that this is God's kingdom. You know, it's not somewhere in the ethereal world. It's not somewhere, you know, nondescript. It's here. It's where I am in the presence of Christ. If I'm willing to defend Christ, I stand in the kingdom of God. So, whoa, huh?
There's a priest that talks about that. It's like after we read the gospel and you hear everyone saying, you know, jubilantly, you know, lost to be Christi or glory be, whatever the response is sometimes. And he goes, we should be in tears, terrified of what we just heard to live that out. It's not just, oh yeah, yeah, cool. And we'll sit back down, cross our legs. Here comes the sermon, blah, blah, blah. That's a different mindset.
And most people don't realize that when Pontius Pilate hung on the cross, INRI in three different languages, when he said, this is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, and he wouldn't take it down, even though, you know, Caiaphas said, take it down. He signed his own death warrant right then and there, because you could not proclaim anybody a king other than Caesar. Yeah. And you know, we have to think about what did he do to proclaim Christ?
So any other tidbits from the Floridians?
People love to say, compare us to the California Mission Chain. But you have to remember, California Mission Chain, completely different. 150 years later, the Spaniards went in with huge military presence. They built the mission chain. That's why they're still in existence. It's not really harmonious with Native American culture. And they enticed the Native people from their village to come and live in the Christian village.
Right, right.
So completely different approach to evangelization than what we see happening.
Stories of Pharaoh ringing the bell to bring them in. Yep. And stuff. Yeah.
Right, right. Point. Completely different approach than what we see here in La Florida.
So, but there's a trail. Is that what the
There was a trail called the Camino Real. You know, the folks, the Tumuqua people in St. Augustine, which was called the city of Saloy before Menendez renamed it St. Augustine, San Agustin, they were phenomenal, like import-export city. They were very good linguists. They had a written language before the first Europeans came. We have the right combination of limestone and oyster shells. And if you grind it up and mix it together and set it on fire, you get a very high, dry heat. So they had perfected like preserving meats and fish, and it was a commodity. It was an import-export commodity. So we know that Native Americans came from very far north to come and trade for these goods. They came from the west, maybe as far as Pensacola, Mobile, to trade for these goods. So there was already a trail, you know, kind of going east, west, and north, south to St. Augustine. And then when the missionaries came, when the Franciscans came and were wandering out in the woods, they followed that Camino Real.
What else are we missing that I haven't brought up that's been like, man, I wish this guy would ask this question. I can talk about. Did we cover enough or what?
Well, I think we did a good job. I think it's important to say that the reason there are no missions left here from the original, that first Spanish period, is we have to remember the Native people built it, and they built it in keeping with their own culture and with their own harmonious way that they lived with nature. They did not have this concept of ownership of the land, like so many Europeans have this concept of ownership. And it's kind of interesting. One of our researchers, who's no longer with us, God bless his soul, Father Rodriguez, Dominican, who represented the Dominican interests in this cause, he found evidence that showed that the King and Queen of Spain actually paid rent for the property that the Castillo de San Marcos, the fort, sits on.
Imagine
so they
that.
Didn't take it from the Indians.
Imagine that one.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't hear that one from anybody.
No, you don't, and you don't. And we didn't have the same problem with the European diseases that you see up north. Because Spain was very protective of the native people here. I mean, we have a couple of, you know, yellow fever epidemics. We had a flu epidemic. But, you know, the archaeologists tell us that just as many Spaniards as Native Americans died. You know, the Spanish were here to protect the health of the people, not to ruin it, which is why they didn't give them alcohol. You know, so far different than the British, who intentionally impregnated blankets with measles, mumps, rubella, smallpox, gave them as gifts because they realized that they could wipe out an entire village in just a short period of time through these European diseases that they were immune to, and they could save their lead for hunting and for defense.
It's, again, it just shows that past this prologue, because again, I think about what happened in the West and how the Protestants came in and gave them alcohol after they went to the U.S. government to get U.S. grant to kick out the Catholic priests. They put in the Protestants, they gave them alcohol, let them kill themselves, get rid of them, they take the land over.
Yeah. And they knew that their metabolism was such that they were at high risk of alcohol poisoning because they weren't used to any kind of a sugar. You know, they didn't have a sugar in their diet. And so it wouldn't take but maybe two or three stiff drinks to really start alcohol poisoning these people.
Man. So where else, where can they find, obviously you got the website, where else can they find more info or?
Well, website is important for the Florida Martyrs. There is a little testimonial book that you can get on Amazon called The Florida Martyrs Compelled by Compassion. This is one man's journey in studying and learning about the Florida Martyrs for the first time just after the opening of the cause. So it's a compendium of the 86 men, women, and children whose names were presented for the opening of the cause. And again, I just caution people that, you know, some of the names that are in this book are going to be in group two, not in group one. So it's a work in progress, but it's a fascinating book about one man's journey and his introduction to the Martyrs of La Florida and the effect that they've had on him. He's a member of a men's group called the Sons of Our Lady here in Jacksonville, St. Augustine area. And they meet on Saturday mornings at 6 a.m., 6:30. So they've been very supportive of the Martyrs of La Florida. We started a spiritual adoption program here in the Diocese of St. Augustine, where parishes or groups could adopt one of the martyrs, and they could begin their prayer journey with that martyr and for that martyr. And for the men in this Sons of Our Lady group, they adopted the wife of Don Patricio, who was the head chief of the entire Apalachee Nation. He and his wife were both martyred, defending the Catholic faith. And it's interesting because a lot of the men in the first part of the group were either divorced or estranged from their wives and their family. And it's just beautiful to see how, having adopted the wife of Don Patricio, you know, they've come to terms with where they are right now and in their journeys with their families. They've learned to pray for their families, pray for their wives, pray for their children. It's just been a beautiful, you know, like an added bonus, if you will.
That is fantastic. No, Doctor, it's awesome talking to you about this stuff. Again, I'll put the links in the show notes. The prayer cards, is that available on the website you mentioned about that?
Well, there is a prayer card, but like I said, we're in the process right now of rewriting the prayer for canonization, because of new historical evidence that clears up Antonio's title. It's Anisia, not Quipa, the number of people involved in the first group. And so we just feel called that we're going to reissue a new prayer for canonization. So we have a new artist rendition of Antonio on the cross, because we now know that, like on our prayer card, Antonio is pictured with his hands tied up over his head, but we know that he was truly crucified. Right. So the prayer card, I mean, we ask people to still pray it. Yeah. Pray for their canonization, pray for their intercession in your lives. Record those intercessions if you can, and please send them to us. It becomes part of the FAMA. It becomes part of this whole process of canonization. But just know that a more accurate artistic rendition of Antonio's martyrdom will be coming out with a new prayer card here very soon.
Oh, very cool. Now, again, thanks. Appreciate your education on this topic and your push to bring these to the Vatican as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we're all called to be martyrs. You know, like Mother Angelica says, we're all called to be saints, but saints and martyrdom are kind of, John Paul II helped us with that. He helped us truly understand what is a white martyrdom. And a white martyrdom is that slow process of every day giving over a little bit more of yourself to the will of God. And you know, where a martyr does, you know, body, soul, boof, like that, you know, in a split second, sometimes a little longer, but in a split second, you know, white martyrdom should be no different. It just takes us a little longer. We tend to hold on to things a little too much more. Whereas if we could just learn to turn our will over to the will of God, we could become a white martyr.
And also, I look at this going, this is, again, Catholic pride in a sense. I mean, you know your roots, know where you come from, know where you can, know what, you know, who came before you. And then this should spur, like, kind of set on fire a little bit more enthusiasm in yourself.
Yeah. Well, I would say Catholic joy.
Yeah.
Because it's a joy that, you know, pride sometimes is something that is almost selfish, you know, singleness, but a joy is something you want to spread and share. I want to see somebody be as joyful about their belief in Jesus Christ and the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist as these people were, because they were joyful.
Yes.
You know, even though they were tortured and abused and enslaved, these Catholics were joyful because they knew where the real presence of Christ was. They had a direct link with God, through God.
Now, like I said, Doc, appreciate it. And again, maybe down the road we can do if when there's any updates on the canonization process, etc.
Should be coming. We're hoping to conclude the diocesan phase by October.
Okay. Okay. I'll definitely.
So yeah, I'll try to keep you up, you know, call me in October and see, is it happening? Because there will be a huge ceremony in Tallahassee in a field. It's an open field, but a site of one of the missions. And, you know, once the diocesan phase is concluded, it's back in the hands of the Vatican, and we just have to wait for their historians to say, all they have to document is, yes, these people died defending the faith.